This evening we're going to be talking about King Ahaz, and this is the start of a pair of lessons we'll do between this week and next, comparing, or really more accurately, contrasting King Ahaz and his son King Hezekiah. As you can probably gather from the title of this lesson, King Ahaz is the abominable one, the one who does not lead Judah into any good place, and Hezekiah does a lot better. He reforms Judah, reforms the temple worship, and is working to bring his people closer to God. But we need to see what Ahaz has done to the nation in order to set the stage for what Hezekiah will need to do. So we're going to stay within three different chapters, 2 Chronicles 28, 2 Kings 16, and Isaiah 7, all talking about what happens with Ahaz. But just to briefly set the stage for you, in 2 Chronicles 27, we get a short report of the reign of Jotham. Jotham is Ahaz's father. He is a righteous king. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord. He imitated his father's successes, but not his failures, which is what every father wants out of their children. He had successful building projects as a king. He prevailed against the Ammonites, and he compelled them to pay a large tribute to him. He was mighty because he ordered his ways before the Lord his God. And so when he died, he was given a royal burial. But Jotham was not able to change the practices of the people. They were still worshiping idols, though it was not sanctioned by the king, though he did not want them to do so. He was not able to institute the sweeping reforms throughout the nation that were necessary in removing all the high places and getting the people to be closer to God. So Jotham's son Ahaz takes over at the age of 20, and he reigns for 16 years. And he is not much like his father. If Jotham imitated his father's successes but not his failures, really, Ahaz did the opposite. He learned nothing from his father's successes and was content to fail in as many ways as possible. And with a people who were still worshiping idols and still willing to be absent in their responsibilities to God, conditions were ripe for Ahaz to make things a lot worse. Well, let's read 2 Chronicles 28, verses 1 through 4, to see the beginning of the reign of King Ahaz. 2 Chronicles 28, verse 1, Ahaz was 20 years old when he began to reign, and he had reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as his father David had done, but he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even made metal images for the Baals, and he made offerings in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burned his sons as an offering, according to the abominations of the nations, whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. And he sacrificed and made offerings on the high places, and on the hills, and under every green tree. Ahaz did not act like his father Jotham, and he did not act like David. If you are familiar with the accounts in Kings and Chronicles, then you will remember that the kings are judged against the actions of David, because David was the archetype of sorts for what a good and godly king should be. But it doesn't mean he was perfect. It doesn't mean that he always did everything that was right, but he was a man after God's own heart, and he was seeking God throughout his life. And so he becomes a standard by which these historians writing these books are able to say this king acted like his father David, or he did not. And in the case of Ahaz, he most certainly did not. Now, Jotham might not have been able to stop the people from worshiping idols, but at least he didn't do it himself, and he was not encouraging them to worship idols. Ahaz did more than just allow it. It was more than he couldn't stop them or he even tacitly approved of it. He was actually making more images of the Baals to fill the many high places. He personally made sacrifices and offerings to those gods. So he is perpetuating idolatry throughout the land and helping it to grow in ways that Judah has not seen in some time. Secondly, we are told that he sacrificed his sons in the Valley of the Sons of Hinnom. Now, you may or may not be familiar with what this means. The Valley of the Sons of Hinnom was essentially a dump, a valley outside of Jerusalem that they took all the trash to. So the garbage of the city, the dead animals that needed to be disposed of, they're all thrown into this valley. And there were fires perpetually burning there in order to cut through the volume of what was being disposed of. So not exactly a fun place to go hang out. This is not a place you go to explore or go to have a good time. It's a place where you throw the garbage and you get out of whatever hellish burning fumes are there. However, something else developed in this dump, in this valley, that they began erecting these altars and images to the god Molech. Why would you do such a thing in a burning valley of trash? Typically with these altars and images, they put them in high places, in places that were thought to be holy and supernatural and special, a place that people would want to go. We put Molech in the trash heap. Well, that's because the worship of Molech was a little bit different. Molech is derived from the Hebrew word melech, which just means king. This is the great king god. And so really, they probably said melech, although there were others who said Milcom and some other versions of this as well. Some of the later scribes in writing these things down did not want to use the word king to describe this god, believing that that was blasphemous and was improper because of how evil Molech was. And so supposedly they took the vowels from the Hebrew word that meant shameful thing, took the O and the E from that, and put them where the vowels were in Melech. And so you go from Melech to Molech, or Molech. And so this is supposed to be kind of a subtle reference that although he is the great king god, he is a shameful god. What makes him so shameful other than just being an idol? Well, I want you to imagine being in this burning trash heap of a valley where there are carcasses of dead animals on fire, where you have just huge heaps of garbage all burning, and a metal statue of a figure with a bull's head and arms outstretched. A baby or a child would be tied to the hands of the god, a fire lit beneath, and as the fire burned the child, the priests would beat on drums to drown out the cries of their sacrifice. It's just evil. It's awful. And it was not uncommon. It was surprisingly common for them to sacrifice their children in this way. And this isn't because, it's really easy for us to do this. We can say, well, these are ancient people. They were simpler than we were. They didn't love their children like we do. Yeah, they did. They loved their children like we do. They're people, like we are people. And they weren't forced into offering up. Nobody had a sword to their back saying, you must offer your child to this god. So what would possess them to do such a thing? Well, they believed that Molech was so powerful that he could help them in a variety of ways, that he could give them military victory. He could give them power to overcome whatever enemy was oppressing them. And they believed that they needed to go to these extreme and desperate measures to get Molech's attention so that he would bless them. And this was a common thing in paganism, that you had to get the attention of the gods, of these supernatural forces, and so you had to do something drastic. Do you remember the priests of Baal cutting themselves, literally spilling their own blood to try to get the attention of Baal in the conflict on Mount Carmel with Elijah? This is an extension of the same sort of idea. Molech is so powerful, but he's not going to pay attention to us unless we can do something so extreme that he has no choice but to see. They believed that even more strongly than that love that they had for their children, but they needed to do this to appeal to the power of this false and evil deity. And Ahaz did this as well. Ahaz did not just perpetuate the worship of Molech and the sacrifices to this evil god. He participated with his own children, his own sons. I don't have great words for what I think of Ahaz, because this is one of the most evil things that I can imagine. And so this, along with everything else about Ahaz, is why it is said in verse 3 that he acted according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord drove out before the people of Israel. Ahaz and the nation that he leads look disturbingly similar to the Canaanites that God had punished when Israel took the promised land. If you were in our Joshua class back when we were doing that here in the auditorium on Sunday mornings, you will remember that we had to grapple with the question of why is God sending his people into a land that is occupied? People are already living in Canaan. And why is God telling them to kill all of these people and take the land for themselves? That is an aggressive thing to do. They are not defending themselves against the Canaanites. They are attacking them. They are taking their land. And there was a variety of reasons for that, but the strongest reason was that this was God's judgment against a very evil people. But they had gotten so wicked that God was bringing his righteous judgment against them, and it was their time to die. Now, what does it say when we can read that Judah and Ahaz looked more like those Canaanites than the people that God made a covenant with? There are giant red flags, blaring klaxons, warning that something is deeply wrong with God's people. And things are going to get worse. Turn over to 2 Kings chapter 16. 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 5 through 9. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up to wage war on Jerusalem, and they besieged Ahaz, but could not conquer him. At that time, Rezin, the king of Syria, recovered Elath for Syria, and drove the men of Judah from Elath, and the Edomites came to Elath, where they dwell to this day. So Ahaz sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying, I am your servant and your son. Come up and rescue me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who are attacking me. Ahaz also took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and the treasures of the king's house and sent a present to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria listened to him. The king of Assyria marched up against Damascus and took it, carrying its people captive to Kir, and he killed Rezin. Ahaz faces a big problem, and you need to understand some of the geopolitics of the area to see why this is such a problem. Assyria is a huge threat to everyone in the vicinity. They are growing rapidly. They are much stronger than any other nation, and they have an aggressive mentality that shows that they are going to invade everyone around them if given enough time. So Israel and Syria, two nations that are much smaller than Assyria, have banded together to try to form this alliance so they're able to stand up against Assyria. Well, why are they then attacking Judah? Really what they want to do is force Judah's hand in joining this alliance. Ahaz is not willing to do so. He has no desire to make Assyria mad at him. He thinks that he can maybe be allies or a vassal of Assyria, and Israel and Syria need to put him in his place in order to make him not a threat or to get him to join their cause. And so Rezin and Pekah come up with their armies to lay siege to Jerusalem. That siege fails. They are not successful in conquering Jerusalem. But Rezin and Pekah don't just run away with their tails between their legs. They capture the important port city of Eliph. And if we were to compare to 2 Chronicles 28:18, we would also see that Ahaz loses several other important cities. And not just to Rezin and Pekah attacking, but also to the Philistines that are taking advantage of the situation. They're coming and they're taking several other cities. And there's a list there of Gimzo and Aijalon, Timnah, Beth Shemesh, Soko, and Gederoth. All of those are strategic cities. It's easy for us to get a little lost in the names and go, okay, he lost some number of cities. I don't know where those are or if they're significant. The point is that those cities were in these strategic passes that led to Jerusalem. Remember that the land of Canaan was a land of lots of hills and valleys, and it was not easy to travel across those mountains. You went through the passes, and the roads went through the passes. And so you had cities at these different points, and now several of those strategically important cities have been lost. So put yourself in the shoes of Ahaz. He's in trouble. He's got Israel and Syria against him. He has these concerns about Assyria growing more powerful, that they might come and squash him like a bug at any moment. And then he's losing cities to the Philistine armies as well. And so Ahaz is desperate, and he asks Tiglath-Pileser, who I'm incredibly bummed out I have to say his name this many times tonight. That is quite a name. But Tiglath-Pileser is the king of Assyria. And he is very mighty and powerful. And it says here that Ahaz sends a gift to him, a present to him. But really, that's not the best word for this. More literally, that word is bribe. And some of the translations do reflect that. That he has sent a bribe to the king of Assyria in order to ask for his help. He is submitting himself to Tiglath-Pileser in saying, I am your servant, I am your son, please come and help me. And in order to bribe him into doing so, because why should Tiglath-Pileser care anything about the plight of Judah, he has to strip the temple and the king's house of the silver and gold and anything valuable in order to send this bribe to him. This is pretty desperate. This is not something that you would just ordinarily do. He's not taking something from the harvest or something from the stores that they have. He's stripping their valuable places in order to come up with something to ask for help. Now, the people, I'll get to that in a moment, the people of Judah are terrified that Israel and Syria are now allies. If you turn over to Isaiah 7, verses 1 and 2, Isaiah 7, 1 and 2, it says, in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not yet mount an attack against it. When the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. So, morale is low. Add on to all the other problems that Ahaz has, that now his people are afraid, and now he is afraid. Nobody believes that they're going to be able to overcome this. We need Assyria to come and to save us. Now, God even tells Ahaz that he should ask for a sign. God is telling him, don't be afraid. I want you to trust in me. And if you will do that, then I will defend you. Then I will give you victory. Let's keep reading in Isaiah 7, beginning in verse 3. And the Lord said to Isaiah, go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to the washer's field, and say to him, be careful, be quiet, do not fear, and do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrands, at the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria and the son of Remaliah. Because Syria, with Ephraim and the son of Remaliah, has devised evil against you, saying, let us go up against Judah and terrify it, and let us conquer it for ourselves, and set up the son of Tabeel as king in the midst of it. Thus says the Lord, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin. And within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people, and the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. Again, the Lord spoke to Ahaz, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, and I will not put the Lord to the test. And he said, Hear then, O house of David. Is it too little for you to weary men, that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. He shall eat curds and honey, when he knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good. For before the boy knows how to refuse the evil and choose the good, the land whose two kings you dread will be deserted. The Lord will bring upon you and upon your people and upon your father's house such days as have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah, the king of Assyria. God wants Ahaz to rely on him. He says, do not be afraid of Syria and Israel. I am not with Syria and Israel. They are wicked, and they are not going to see any success. They come up against you to attack. You have no reason to be afraid. I will not allow them to win. Believe this. And God knows that Ahaz doesn't believe this. And so God does something that is honestly kind of shocking to me here. It's hard to even imagine being in this position. But God tells Ahaz, ask me for a sign, and let it be a good one. Let it be whatever you want, as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. Ask me for a sign to prove that what I say is true. Ahaz kind of worms his way out of that by quoting something that is in the covenant, that you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. He says, I will not put the Lord to the test. But really what that verse is about is you shall not be faithless to the Lord. You shall not disobey the Lord, which is exactly what Ahaz has been doing. God's telling him, I want to give you victory. I want to be with you, and if you will seek me, then I will give you victory. And Ahaz just doesn't seem to care. He'll sacrifice his sons to Molech to ask for help, but he won't even listen to what Yahweh has to say. He won't even ask for the sign that God tells him to ask for. You know, we can rag on Gideon sometimes for some of the strange decisions he made and the many things that he asked of God. But at least Gideon was kind of trying. At least Gideon was trying to build some faith in asking for these signs and looking for confirmation. And his faith starts out pretty weak, but it does grow. Ahaz isn't even at that point. Ahaz isn't even willing to listen to Yahweh or to ask for the sign that God tells him to ask for. And so Isaiah is furious at this. And he now is speaking personally, and he says, is it too little for you to weary men that you must weary my God also? Ahaz has wearied men in the sense that his people are upset, the morale is low, he has not been a very good or successful king, and the patience of his people is wearing thin. Well, now Ahaz is doing the same thing with God. He is testing God's patience. And though he claims the moral high ground of I will not put the Lord to the test, He's putting the Lord to the test by being disobedient and refusing to listen. So God gives him a sign anyway. He says, here's the sign. I'll pick it for you. A child will be born to a virgin and named Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. And before that child is old enough to refuse evil and choose good, kind of traditionally meaning around 12 years old, was the age that they traditionally thought of as when a child could make those decisions for himself, Israel and Syria will be deserted. They will not be a threat anymore. Before this child that's about to be born is 12 years old, it will be evident that these threats are not threats to you. But they're going to be replaced by a greater threat that Ahaz won't be able to stop. A powerful Assyria that is determined to conquer and destroy. And Ahaz is working so hard to get Tiglath-Pileser to be on his side that he doesn't even realize that he's creating his own enemy that will eventually be his own ruin. And so, God with us, that name Emmanuel, is going to be true in two distinct ways in the days of Ahaz. God is with Judah, present in Judah, in a positive sense that he will protect them from Israel and Syria. Rezin and Pekah are not going to be able to conquer Jerusalem. They're not going to be able to compel Judah to do anything. So that is a good protection from God. But negatively, God is with Judah, among Judah, in using Assyria to judge them. Problems are coming down the road, and things will not be good for Judah. Putting your trust in an enemy is a mistake. God will punish them soon. Look at 2 Kings 16, verses 10 through 18. 2 Kings 16, verses 10 through 18. We saw that Tiglath-Pileser has protected Judah. Syria has been conquered, and Israel will not be far behind. And so he is now the savior of Judah. And now Ahaz is compelled to offer tribute to him and to be the vassal of this king. Verse 10, when King Ahaz went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, he saw the altar that was at Damascus. And King Ahaz sent to Uriah the priest a model of the altar and its pattern, exact in all its details. And Uriah the priest built the altar in accordance with all that King Ahaz had sent from Damascus. So Uriah the priest made it before King Ahaz arrived from Damascus. And when the king came from Damascus, the king viewed the altar. And the king drew near to the altar and went up on it and burnt his burnt offering and his grain offering and poured his drink offering and threw the blood of his peace offerings on the altar. And the bronze altar that was before the Lord he removed from the front of the house, from the place between his altar and the house of the Lord, and put it on the north side of his altar. And King Ahaz commanded Uriah the priest, saying, on the great altar burn the morning burnt offering and the evening grain offering and the king's burnt offering and his grain offering with the burnt offering of all the people of the land and their grain offering and their drink offering, and throw on it all the blood of the burnt offering and all the blood of the sacrifice. But the bronze altar shall be for me to inquire by. Uriah the priest did all this as King Ahaz commanded. And King Ahaz cut off the frames of the stands and removed the basin from them. And he took down the sea from off the bronze oxen that were under it and put it on a stone pedestal. And the covered way for the Sabbath that had been built inside the house and the outer entrance for the king, he caused to go around the house of the Lord because of the king. Ahaz is now bound to go to Assyria and to pay tribute to Tiglath-Pileser. This is not an alliance. This is not a friendship. He has reached out in desperation to Assyria, and Tiglath-Pileser deigned to be his hero, but now there are obligations. And the bribe that was sent before was there to try to compel Tiglath-Pileser to act quickly and to come and to save them. But now there's an ongoing relationship that needs to be maintained. Now Judah has lost some of its independence. It is not able to function by itself any longer. It now is a vassal of Assyria. They are indebted to their saviors. And so he's going to Damascus in order to pay his respects and give his thanks to his hero, and also to bring this tribute. And we see some things happening that show how he is going to pay that tribute. He, again, remember, was in such a desperate place before that he had to take the gold and the silver from the temple and from the king's palace to pay the bribe. Well, what's he going to pay the tribute with? Well, now we need to strip the bronze out of these places. So in the temple, they had a lot that was made of bronze, and bronze obviously is not worth the same as silver or gold, but it is worth something, and it is all there. And so he's able to do things like take off the frames of the supports of things. And if you remember the great sea that's outside of the temple, it was this great basin that held the water that they would use for some of the temple rites. It was in this large basin, and it was on top of, if I'm remembering correctly, these 12 oxen, 12 bronze oxen that were a stand for it. Well, he says, okay, we don't really need this sort of support for it, this sort of stand for it. Let's take the basin off of that and take these bronze oxen, and now that's something we can pay our tribute with. You know, when you start making decisions like these, it's clear that it's desperation. And it's not a good alliance or friendship with Assyria. He is trying to meet obligations. You know, if try to imagine if you heard that, you know, we were stripping the White House of the copper and the wiring in order to pay something. Like, that's not a good sign for what the nation would be doing or our ability to pay debts. That's kind of analogous to what's happening here. They're taking parts of the temple and parts of the palace that have stood for generations and stripping anything valuable out of them in order to pay this tribute. Well, when Ahaz is in Damascus, he sees the great altar that they have for their offerings, and he says, I like that. That's a wonderful altar that they're using to worship their gods. I want to build one just like it. And you know, when you're having to strip the temple and the palace of anything of value, you would think maybe you don't have the resources to be building great new giant altars, but somehow they find the money, the resources, the materials for that. And he sends a model of this back to the priest and says, I want you to build one just like this. And Uriah does that, and the temple to the, I mean, the altar to the Lord is moved out of the way. We don't need to worry about that right now. All of this is to ingratiate himself to Tiglath-Pileser, to show that he is a good vassal, and to thank him for using his power and his connections with these gods that he worshipped in order to save them from Israel and Syria. And you know what? He has been saved from Israel and Syria. But there are problems. And this has not gone as well for him as he would think. Let's make some applications here. Firstly, disobeying God only ever makes things worse. Ahaz thought he needed to offer his sons to Molech and to vassalize himself to Tiglath-Pileser in order to solve his problems. He thought that this was going to be how he got the power and the help that he needed to overcome his enemies. He refused to ask God for help or to listen to anything that God told him. And the really sad thing about this is it didn't even really work. It says that he angered God, he angered his own people, and he put his enemy in a position to control him. He sort of solved his short-term problem, but he tripled his other problems. And now they've become so much worse. And whatever he thought he was going to get out of this relationship with the king of Assyria, we can read 2 Chronicles 28, 20 and 21 and see the end of that. So Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came against him and afflicted him instead of strengthening him. For Ahaz took a portion from the house of the Lord and the house of the king and of the princes and gave tribute to the king of Assyria, but it did not help him. It didn't help. It didn't work. He weakened his nation. He weakened his position. He made more problems, and Assyria came in and caused so much grief and destruction in just a few short years. Sometimes we are determined to try anything and everything to get to desperate measures, except we won't try just obeying God. We won't try just listening to what God has told us. We come up with these very creative solutions to problems in our lives and think that we are backed in a corner and there's nothing else that we can do, but we've not actually tried just doing what God says. God has given us such guidance for our lives to show us how we ought to live, and there's good reason behind his commands. When we disobey him, we invite trouble into our lives, and that trouble makes us even more desperate and makes us look for another opportunity to try to fix it, which is so often done by bringing even more trouble in. Just listen to God. Just obey what he has commanded, and you will find that you avoid so much of the trouble that leads to that desperation in the first place. Obeying God can be hard, but it is important for us to do, and it is actually effective in our lives. And then secondly, God is faithful. God was faithful, and he continued to push for Ahaz to seek him. I am amazed that God reached out so much to Ahaz when Ahaz was not righteous at all. That God continued to say, Ahaz, I want to protect you and defend you, and I want to give you a sign. Ask me for the sign that will be enough to prove that I am with you. God was a whole lot more faithful than Ahaz ever was. And that's the story of the character of God, that he is more consistent than we are. He is more reliable than we are. God protected Judah from Israel and Syria, all to show Ahaz that he could rely on him, all to show Ahaz that he would follow through with his covenant promise. And then, even when Ahaz wasn't interested in a sign, he gave him a sign through the birth of the child Emmanuel, that Israel and Syria would be destroyed. And that was something that Ahaz could look at and see actually came to pass. Ahaz had opportunity to learn better that God was consistent and faithful. Of course, there's even greater prophecy tied up in that promise of a future Emmanuel. There was an Emmanuel then, and there was an Emmanuel some years later, born of a virgin, who came to bring peace and reconciliation with God. And that second Emmanuel is an even greater expression of God's faithfulness to a rebellious and sinful people who abandoned him long ago. Praise be to God that he was faithful with us even when we were not faithful to him. God has not stooped to our level, and we must be thankful for that. However, Ahaz died without learning his lesson. Ahaz was not given the royal burial. He was buried in Jerusalem, but he was not buried along with the other kings. He was remembered as a weak and ineffective and evil and unpopular king, because he did not serve God. He had every opportunity to do so. And God showed him in innumerable ways why he should listen to him. And again he refused. What about you? Are you learning your lessons from how God is working in your life? Are you learning to trust in Him, or are you growing more stubborn like Ahaz did? You know, we have this conceit where we believe that we're eventually going to figure things out, that eventually it's going to make sense, and eventually I'm going to make better choices. But you know, there are always people who are rebellious and sinful and evil throughout all of their days, and they never learn. Don't be such a person. Remember God, remember His faithfulness, and submit yourself to Him. Be faithful to Him. If we can help you tonight, we'd ask you to come forward and let us know as we stand and sing.